It's a delight to have you here tonight and to be in your company. It's also a delight to be in the presence of my daughters in their company, and we've not done this before. We've done it a couple of us, but we've not been in a place where the three of us were together. So we're delighted to be here. We're very different from each other, as some of you who may know, but the one thing that we share, we love to string words together. We string them together and create our ideas, our impressions, our memories. It's a way of leaving tracks. We write about the things that we feel passionately about, and each in our own way, we love this thing called writing. So tonight we're going to read together. We have not tried to make it thematically cohesive or anything. We're just going to do our thing. And Allison's going to lead off and introduce herself a little bit, and then Rebecca, and then I will. So here goes.
Hi. I'm used to doing this with music in front of me instead of with just words, but we're just going to be doing some words tonight. And I'll try to remember to breathe. The first thing I want to start off with is something that I wrote in a poetry tutorial that I took from my mother at college, my junior year, I think. It's called What I Left Behind. What I left behind in order to be here, this time, this place, is kind of hard to say. I'm in a classroom with my mother. An odd juxtaposition, but I think I can handle it. I sometimes lie and say I never learned anything from her, but of course we both know better. In order to be here, I left behind my identity as a writer. I don't write poetry, I've told everyone I know. When I put pen to paper, essays come, or journals, never poetry. My mother, now she's a poet, and a damn good one, too. So rather than try to follow that act, I've turned long-winded. Pages roll out from this hand, margin to margin, sometimes a paragraph to offset a thought, but never a mind to the space on the page outside the words. But today I am attempting poetry, drawing on my mother's mind, my own too, I suppose. Sometimes it's hard to tell which is which. So I left behind a relationship I grew up with, and have begun to stretch the boundaries of these two people, you and me.
The clapping feels good, but I wonder, is it better at the end of all of us?
Of each person.
Or of each, yeah, of each person. Why don't we do that?
This next one was another writing practice from her class, where we just picked a column of about six or so unrelated words, and we were to use them all in the same poem and write for 10 minutes without stopping. This is called This Train. Now that this train has left the platform, there's no getting off till it gets where it's going. Nothing to do but lean against the window, press my nose to the one-way glass, watch whatever passes by. Still in the city, the industrial quarter, train tracks always find the poorest part of town. I am limited to a weary vision of brick building after brick building. Tattered posters cover their walls in a desperate bid for attention, but dusk is falling and no one looks, no one even notices. My head in my hands, I close my eyes, try to forget the movement of this train, this endless knocking of steel on steel. For an instant, I can see an open yard, a spring sky, the sapling I planted there when I was 10, the remembered feel of moist dirt on my hands, under my fingernails, brings a sudden tightness to my chest. Another knock, and I open my eyes again to the inside of this train, an endless brick building, still moving relentlessly past the smoky one-way glass. Mm-hmm. This next one is called Indecision. I wrote it just specifically about what it says, but afterward it turned out to be about a lot more things than just the weather. I can't decide if it's winter or spring. Last night as I walked home in the indigo twilight, shot through with sunset purples, I took off my jacket, breathed deeply of new green. Last week, a string of mild days left pools of standing water in the grass, reflecting the high noon sun. I took off my shoes to feel fresh mud between my toes. But today, I awoke to a low gray sky, thick with snow, falling fast. Huge wet flakes blur the edges of my vision, throw into question both time and space. Outside, I turn up my collar against the sloppy kisses falling uninvited on my neck. This next poem is written for a friend, for AB. The road from my house to yours, my friend, is a long and uncertain road. It would take many maps that I don't have to find my way from here to your door. It's too far to walk. It's not safe for a woman to hitch. It would take a car that I don't have, money for gas that I don't have, friends with spare rooms in the right places that I don't have. It would take hours of travel through rolling farmlands and city after city to get to where you live. Thank God for modern technology, at least they've put up telephone poles one after another along the ditches of every road. In an instant I can speak to you across the miles that separate for the fraction of the cost of a one-way ticket. I look at the cement beneath my feet and know that if I had directions, I could follow it right to your door. I wouldn't have to touch green earth for even a single instant. But that road between me and your arms, my friend, is long and complicated. I'd need directions, a means of travel, a freedom to leave this place for a while that, at least for now, I simply do not have. This next poem is untitled. It's one that I wrote to a woman who was in a class with me at St. Olaf. We were in a writing class together. She was a Korean-American and had been adopted into a Christian family whose Christian mission it was to save this baby from non-Christian backgrounds. So this was a response to her as a lesbian. Your stories are intense, your issues so charged that I don't know how to respond to your words. I look at my own and think, how trite. Your adoptive family robbed you of the legitimacy of your life, your self-respect, dignity, a sense of worth. You struggle to claim your rightful heritage, regain a strength of mind and soul. That journey is powerful, emotional, deep. Your words are a matter of life and death. For me this year, in this safe place, surrounded by a supportive family, my struggles sometimes don't seem so big. But today, your family has robbed me, too, of my legitimacy, my self-respect. You tell me with an easy smile that your father has forbidden you from being my friend or even classmate because I am sick, disgusting, perverse. You repeat him word for word to my face. It must be awful for the parents. You've got to wonder what's wrong with the family, got to wonder what's wrong with her. You laugh because you know it's absurd, and I realize that it helps you to tell me this. But that doesn't stop me from wanting right now to put my clenched fist through those smiling teeth. I know sometimes I laugh too, for lack of a better response to hate. But sometimes I bear the blows better than others. I know too well the malice this culture has for me. I don't want to hear it again. I don't want to hear it from you. I don't need another knife in my heart. I know I smile as you talk, sit uncomfortably before you, but it is difficult to remain aloof, to laugh, stand strong, and go about business pretending that it doesn't matter. Frozen, wordless, I watch you leave as a sick feeling swells. Today I am reminded that my struggle too is deep, my words a matter of life, of legitimacy and death. And then to end on a light note, this poem is called Tilt. Mom, my orthodontist was no crazy man like yours was. He just straightened up my teeth like he was paid to do. So tell me, why is it that thousands of dollars and metal and years still couldn't keep this one in place? Just like yours, stubborn, defiant, one crazy tooth has snuck on back to its original, beautiful, lazy tilt. Like you, it seems to be much more at ease, just a little out of line.
Have you heard that?
Well, this is very moving to me to be here with these two. Like Mom said, we've never done this, the three of us, we've been doing it in different places. I think they had a chance to do this, the two of them, earlier. I've only been here for about a week, so. All right. First poem I'm going to read is called Mount Pleasant Hydrangea. I wrote it because 3 years ago my husband and I moved out to Washington, D.C. from Minnesota. And I had never seen hydrangea before, which are these blue, bright blue, very round pom-pom flowers. And they looked completely artificial to me. So after first sighting them, I wrote this poem and thought it was about the flowers and realized later it was more about my sense of claustrophobia and being unnerved about living in Washington, D.C. Mount Pleasant is the area that we live in, our neighborhood. Mount Pleasant Hydrangea. Open the door to find no one who might have knocked, but instead blue flowers hang heavy and obscene from stalks bent over the walk. Not aquamarine, not azure, not even sky blue, but blue like stained carnations, the sharp blue of plastic shovels and pails for the beach, like a notebook with a blue cover, the blue caps of pens. And these are the petals, and these the blue stems that grow in my rooms. At dinner, suddenly they push up through the floor, though the guests don't see how their legs are being wrapped in leaves, how the great blue blooms have reached their napkin laps, the cool bowls of soup. When we walk the streets, no one sees the flowers filling the children's mouths. The men lounging on storefront steps don't feel the blue anthers moving up through their pockets. There are stamens in the eaves, porches and bird baths overrun, pollen spilling from tailpipes, everywhere the brilliant artificial blue that has moved in on and ruined us. The next one is another one about place, but it's kind of two poems, it's two places. It's about fear. It's called Chiroptera, which is a word for bats. And it's about two different events, one in Washington, D.C., one in India, in a small village, where I was walking down the street and noticed this huge tree that was fluttering and then realized why afterwards. It's called Chiroptera. The walk home is later, and so it happens in darker light. Such a wind on the face, on the glamorous graveyard, the city with its bronze horses and their men, and the white stone shrines light up at night like jewels. The air is less supple, less fecund here, The bats are out. In Bangalore, sandalwood incense drops its small heaps of ash. We sat beneath netting, unhinged in sweat, smoking slim, sweet-rolled leaves. Each night, low-pitched whistles came from the well. Then suddenly, there at the screen, tapping canes, as watchmen prowled the grounds, flushing out cobras, ducking bats big as geese. A cat leaps from a neighbor's shrub, a black flash, and I flinch, almost run. Leaves click on branches. They scrape against trunks and gutters, hollowish, no more green in the sound. Something flaps on a low limb. I spin left. Nothing, after all. But still, it comes on, an enormous, fluttering tree. We noticed it because everything else on the street hung so still. How could the great dark leaves be stirring? What breeze had we missed? That tree was full of huge bats. This is a love poem that I wrote for my husband called Prayer. And it starts with a line from Tristan Zara, who was a surrealist poet, Romanian. It reads, I love you so I swear I do adore you. Prayer. From the wreck and tangle of the past moon, the past moment, every minute since this thirst began, I lean. I stumble toward you hoping you've not turned away yet. Hoping there might be something here to hold your falling eyes, tap your feet to the floor. If I could escape my head for one day and come to you as tongue, as open mouth, proud hunger and thighs, as fingernail and footsole, lapis and emerald. If I could come to you without my voice pulling words around the sound, but just carry you with me to the water and walk our bodies in until our mouths are underneath us and making O's, marking us with sucking, octopus and leech. If I could, I would leave the flimsy skin of my intellect on the sand, like a towel, a blouse, to change shape and texture in the wind. This one's called Intarsia, which was the title of my thesis. Intarsia is a kind of mosaic. I decided poems are really that. They're mosaics of our lives, fragments of our memory and our experience and location, places we've been. So this has little fragments of places I have been and scenes of travel that came up in this poem, but I think it's also about the way that all over the world we try to hold ourselves together, physically and emotionally. Intarsia. Next door, a child shifts in sleep. Cats crouch in the roses. There's a man walking coatless through dark rain. And the days fill with such ordinary strangeness that taking the garbage out hurts. I have grown afraid of reflection, of both silence and squalls, of being alone in this. There's a boy in Rome whose eyes broke me, a Thai woman still bringing poppies in from the field. In Jerusalem, a madman wears my watch. There are canaries hanging in doorways and cages, and from the Mount of Olives, such sweeps of cypress and white stone, steam under surfaces, goats on roofs. Thin-legged boys hawk strands of shells. At Cape Comoran, the salt of three seas comes together. An old man wrapped in yellow waits on the rocks. The child next door is asleep in Cochin. The coatless man stands begging for coins in Bombay. His shirt of lace sparkles where it's held together with bits of wire. Tiny pins. This one. Water. This one is maybe my first sacred memory or epiphany. I don't know what it was. It was terrifying. I won't explain it any more than that. I think the poem will. It's called Flower Pot. I was 4 years old when this happened. I wonder if the cat comes with the house, and because I think it might, when they ask me which I like best, I say this one. I can't believe they've given me the power of this. They say we'll live in the house I choose, and I'm suddenly taller. They've gone back inside, so I wait on the concrete, a little courtyard of cement between the house and garage. It's whitish tan like the drawings of Jesus in his country of sand. The driveway is made of gravel. I check to see if there are agates in the dust. I go back to the concrete and sit by the wall. I'm amazed that I have bought this house. I lean against it, inspect the flowers between me and the walk. There are some clay pots there, orangish brown and dull, with blood red flowers and very green leaves. One of the pots is broken. Maybe the cat tipped it over. Maybe someone knocked it down by accident. I know about accidents. The dirt has scattered in clumps and will have to be cleaned up. I look for worms, roots, anything interesting. The pieces of pot have broken into triangle shapes, thick pie wedges. I think I can put them back together like a puzzle. Already, I know I could fit those slices up against each other so you couldn't see the cracks. I could go ask for some glue and fix this flower pot for the people who are going to let us have their house. I'm holding a piece of it when my mother finds me. She tells me to put it down. I'll cut myself. My face turns hot. I'm amazed that I can buy a house, but I'm not supposed to hold this piece of flower pot, which I know I can fix. I try to explain that I'm being careful. See how I'm holding it? Between my finger pads. I'm holding the flat sides. I'm not even close to the ragged edges, which suddenly look like teeth. Shark teeth. My mother says, no, put it down now. So I do, but my face gets hotter, and my fingers are going to work by themselves now. I can feel it. I know how this goes. The fingers that squeeze my brother's wrists till he cries, that hold scissors closing slowly on my own handfuls of hair, fingers that slide down the necks of glass swans and know the feel of the clean, tight snap. When she goes, I pick up the piece of flower pot again because I'm furious she thinks I can't hold it without getting cut. If you do things carefully, you can keep from making a mess and getting hurt. And I'm no fool. I know how this goes. Only, when they come out to find me, I say to the cat watching from the front walk, they are going to be so angry at these cut open hands, at all this blood. I'll never forget it. It was God, you know, telling me parents always know everything. Pick this up. Pat myself. So, two more. This one's new. I've never read this before, too. I guess except to my mother and my grandmothers. I wrote it on Mother's Day for them. And I had never written something for three people at once, but three women that matter immensely to me in my life. So it's called Pask Flowers for my grandmothers and my mother. They don't grow here. It's a button, a leaf, a glitter of glass in the gravel. Then it vanishes, slips into a single dun-colored flake, butterfly leaves, butterfly wings pressed shut. When the low breeze nudges it, it becomes sudden petals, not glass at all, but a scrap of sky, a pasque flower. The wings laid open are my palms spread in joy, a purple instant, a song. And the stones, the gravel, an intricate path of dust, a stream breathing on its way. In the ditch ahead, jewelweed climbs through the ribs of a deer. There are onions and rhubarb, frog throats calling. We look down at our hands, then off through years. Our lives pass and unfold, sweep out around us. We touch like prairie grass, like rain in the trees. And I follow a voice in your voices. The only thing I know is that my own blessing is this braid, the blood of three mothers moving toward me in a way, bringing every exaltation I've known, every resonance and grace, each fierce lesson. Your heads are white light, halos, stars. Each of you is a stone I carry. Each of you, the world I move into again and again. You send angels and red velvet, the moon and Trivandrum, a wedding gown. You have taken me through the hours that circle back, through the darkness that staggers my life. through luxuriant years, my blessed life. Some mornings when I come into the rooms where you've been, I see everything transformed. Every vase shines with light. The yard blossoms and presses toward the windows. The sky is blue glass. The roads lead here where the world grows. Rhubarb crowds the ditch and wild ginger. Wisdom, grace, past flowers spring up wherever you've walked. There are prayers and songs. There are butterflies moving through my hands. And the last one, you need to know the story behind it, I think. I have a cousin my age who grew up doing everything together but had very different styles. She's a more a linear thinker and very concerned about facts and details and precise information, and I'm not. And she went with her husband to Kenya for 2 years, and they were in a very small village. He was a doctor there. And she wrote these long letters full of, you know, maps of what the floor plan of their house and where the garden was and, you know, all kinds of details. But I learned this story that actually she had written to her mother, who told my grandmother, who told my mother. So by the time I heard it, I wasn't sure how real it was. But it was fascinating to me because it was the kind of event my cousin would never be able to explain. And so I wrote this poem about it. And it's called Adiablu, which is a Swahili word for magical. Kenyan stamps on blue tissue, the usual pregnant arrival of words. Always a marvel with facts and specifics, she notices things no one else notices, then shares them with a practical generosity. You might as well know this. And after she says she's grown fat on chocolate, outlines a day of clinical work and tells of a hippo, the green mambas in the yard. There is something else, a woman in labor. Undilated and staring into the eyes of something, she arrived alone from the village. No supplies in the cabinets, no time, and 2 hours of one ruptured dirt road. They carried her to the jeep, knew they'd never make Migori before she collapsed. Then, how stunned we were to find the road repaired. The ruts filled in, tangled roots and rock removed, smoothed over. They made it in 45 minutes, delivered the woman and her child, and afterward asked when the road was restored, how, by whom. Why had they heard no shovels, no singing? The nurses shook their heads, then the hagglers in the market shrugged. At dusk, they turned the jeep for home, lurched back onto the road, and you must know this. She writes of the endless ragged tracks, the old sprawling scar, and how for 2 hours, in silence, they labored their way back, every star beating down. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So a miracle had happened. I couldn't explain. And I sent her this poem after I wrote it and said, you know, is this really true? Is this what happened? She wrote back and said, yeah, that's pretty much it, but it was a Land Rover, not a Jeep. It didn't fit with my meter, so thank you.
Well, it feels like a miracle night of some sort. I think first I will read a piece that I wrote about our family dog, whom we just lost. And she lived with us during the time of the ages of our children young in our home. And she got very sick, she was old. And we tried to save her for a little while. Allison was coming home last summer and we wanted her to be able to see her, but we couldn't do it. And I ended up writing this piece and then followed it with a very brief thing that had me thinking a lot about how we treat the elderly in this country. And that these two pieces don't have answers. But this is called Duchess's Wee Amanda, which was the name of the dog. At 4 a.m., I awoke to Mandy's coughing up something slimy with a tiny white center, yesterday's Lasix. She wanted out. So I rose and opened the door, and she ran barking out under a full moon over and down the slope to the west, briefly at one, with all the other unseen furry or burrowing creatures that were out and moving. When she returned to the door, she didn't want to eat and would not take the pill I had hidden in ice cream and soda crackers. Out again, she moved haltingly toward the neighbor's evergreens, seeming to melt away in the dusk. I realize now if I had not watched her in the next few minutes, she would have moved out of sight and I might never have found her. I went out and gathered her into my arms, but could feel she did not really want me to carry her back in the house. For the next 4 hours, she gasped, her chest heaving relentlessly. She could not lie down, even to rest, and we were at the vet's door when it opened at 8 a.m. At the veterinarian's advice, we left Mandy there to receive fluids all day and returned at 5:30 p.m., fully expecting to bring her home. But when we saw her, it was obvious immediately she would not come home with us. She was so sick. Grateful and happy to see us, she couldn't show it. She hung her head down toward the stainless steel table, seemingly ashamed to be so sick, to be in this place at all. David and I thought our hearts would break. Neither of us could gulp out the words to tell the vet what needed to be done, but neither could we stay with her like that, even for the 10 minutes that the vet had suggested. David soon asked him to come to put her to sleep, and we held her, one on each side of the table, and under our arms she rolled slowly, instantly over onto her side and was still. We slid her into a plastic bag and brought her home in the trunk of the Buick. I commented to the vet how unceremonious it all seemed, and he added, "It's much more than most animals get." So we left her in the car overnight, planning the next day to dig through the frozen top 6 inches of soil in our yard to bury her. And at the last minute changed our minds for Allison's sake, who will come home from Holden Village in the next 10 days. We put Mandy gently into our downstairs freezer to await Allison's farewell to her, her help in deciding the burial place. At least it allows Allison a choice about seeing her. In the context of such unconditional love ends a span of time from 1979 to 92, representing our lives as a young family together. Our children, now grown, range across the country from Washington, D.C. to California to the state of Washington. Allison was 10 when Mandy came to us, Jonathan 13, Rebecca 16. The next evening, we looked through our pet file, and we were surprised to find an American Kennel Club certificate registering Mandy under the name of Duchess's Wee Amanda. I had forgotten she was registered. She had been slightly oversized for a Shetland sheepdog, a Sheltie, and her ear tips not nicely folded down as they ought. Most eerily of all, we had put her down, as farm folks say, on the anniversary of her birthday. Mandy was 13 years old exactly on March 19th. There is one day until spring, and although it's snowing hard, the mourning doves have arrived. And the short poem following is called Creatureliness. We presume so much that the family dog prefers indoors, our company, canned meat. When the time comes, might we not too say nothing? Move due west toward the ghostly trees, and hope no one notices or stops us with catheters, stainless steel counters, and fluids that drip from above. Some of this reading tonight does turn into family celebrations. I have 3 poems here that I'm going to read that are about my mother. This short one. The night before leaving my mother, we sort jewelry, all the red ones together, the greens, then the turquoise, and the gold. My sister and I look at each other, our mother in the lamplight, listening for a call. Maybe his call, as in a kind of dream, a boat. We go to bed, she sleeps, but we do all the rowing. She wouldn't be old but for the pills. Three times a day, Mom takes a fistful of pills. Her hands shake, and I know it's the pills. I doubt it's fear, but who knows? I only know mine. We take a fine trip together to the Black Hills. She says, let's park here. A little walk will do me good. I need the exercise. In half a block, she looks for a place to sit, smiles, and pulls at the pain in her calves with her fingers. Says, go on, take your time. I've been there before. When David and I walk in Deadwood Cemetery with a map in our hands, it shows the way to Calamity and Wild Bill's graves. She was tough, that lady. Is tough. There weren't so many pills in her days. Then again, she didn't get so old, either. After Calamity, we visit the Green Door, which was next to the Blue Door, which had been next to the Purple Door on Deadwood's Main Street. So many tiny rooms strung together on narrow corridors. A rhinestone necklace at the throat of the town, its colorful women, the fake stones so easily replaced if one fell or were lost. Mom waits on a bench at the bottom of those stairs. Her wig keeps the heat in, so I know the sweat has started to run, and we hurry back to the street, then retreat into the dark coolness of Saloon Number 10 and Cherry Cokes. She looks like a girl as her eyes dart around the room, sees the cowboy at the bar with a beard and six guns hanging down, sees Wild Bill's chair framed like a three-dimensional painting high above the door, its pressed back ornate. It appears to be waiting. She slowly sips her Cherry Coke. Some days later, returned home to the Missouri River, she places in my hands a coin collection from the United States bicentennial year. Says it's for my daughter's 21st birthday, 3 years off. Says no one likes to talk of death, says she gets these spells. I know it's the pills and the days narrowing like arteries. And the last one, just this last January, she had a big surgery at Mayo and had an aneurysm repaired. And it was a hard surgery even for young people, but for someone who was 84, it was real rugged. And the morphine that they gave her caused her to hallucinate for several days. And she, this is a woman who doesn't like to dream. She's so practical. So I wrote about this aneurysm. And some of the images in here are what she told us that she was experiencing afterwards. After the deep surgery, they put her out onto the street, she thought. Then the nurses brought in men, caroused, and refused to care for her. Men patients casually went by as she attempted to rise from a commode, having been left there cold, awaiting a nurse who had promised to bring a robe that never came. She hauled herself back to the bed, furious, patronized, scolded even for putting herself to bed, and the morphine hung on for days. She made her favorite daughter cry by accusing her of being in cahoots, both Connie and the hospital trying to kill her. She, my sister, and I sang a trio of old rhymes, Christmas carols, tunes from the 30s, till she interrupted us with, "What ceremony is this?" She thought it last rites. And we found her one morning in restraints, black and blue arms, puffy ballooning fists. She had kicked someone and then tried to rip out the tubes with her stubby fat fingers beyond any reasonable memory that we had of our mother's most unusual hands. Our mother has hands that are, she got them caught in a hay pulley when she was 2.5 years old. So she has only two fingers on each hand, these, and the others are gone. But she beats us at bowling and plays the piano, and it hasn't hindered her very much. And on to a few of our own parenting years. I wrote for David's in my 23rd anniversary. In those early days, we never dreamed what it would be like to parent three young ones and each other, each successive year, each successive child, one new dimension added to the complexity, the compounded errands, the illnesses, the dailiness, till our bodies ached from the weight and the joy. Our son, who was here a few weeks ago, some of you may have met, but he's a professional juggler. And for some years in his youth, he rode a motorcycle, which wasn't a comforting thing for me, but I ended up writing about both of these things in this song. He was leaving to juggle at the Renaissance Fair in Colorado one evening. He had been leaving all day long. I'd wanted him to get an early start in the morning. And he headed out at about 9:30 at night into the teeth of a thunderstorm on his motorcycle. This is called Please. And you can read that any way you want. Your motorcycle hums a spinning song. You whistle and ready yourself. Pack your maps, addresses, sundries, an anniversary card, and my size. Tie them all onto the cycle with your bungee cords. And then you head out into night and dark lightning, spitting clouds. Later your call comes from North Platte. The storm eluded you, tore north and east while you spun south. Now you own your own decisions and are not haunted by the uneasy wind and a mother's pleas. Be careful. Eat well. Do not juggle the torches when they are too hot, or the sickles. Why not the multi-hued scarves instead? Daughters. Up some narrow stairs in a California student's space, my waters broke. Now many dams downstream, the drought has come, and you are gone. The roads are parched, and corduroy rows of corn inch their small heights, heads up in scorching sun. They wave meager plumes of silk at tassels yearning for absent pollen. This is nature's natural cycle, I suspect, and folks will struggle through depleted. But time is on our side, and cool northern air will gather overhead in honor of an always coming season. You and we will walk in sun again, lightning flashing only at the edges. Goodbye. I cannot say the word out loud all day today, you in the driveway, me driving away, though it is you who are leaving. I cannot speak this sorrow, how I will miss you, because I cannot add to your ache. Instead, I give your fiancé a coat of my father's, slip my sorrow into its light gray sleeves, fully clothed, not naked like the part riding north with me. Strange how I knew for months you were going, yet it came too quickly for words. I sit here tonight writing in the chill air 300 miles north of the cities. The birches shiver all the while you drive to Virginia. Did I never tell you that in my world, east is an unnatural direction? Hard to say goodbye when your kids grow up and move away. And I'll read one more that hints at my farm prairie background. I grew up on a ranch in South Dakota and loved it very much. That terrain and my life there has influenced me all of my life. And I still grieve every time I leave, and I have to go home at least once a year or I don't feel complete. So I will read this and then move into a little bit different section. This is called Torrent, and I wrote it as a writing exercise during a rainstorm like this today, where I was writing with a friend, and it was pouring rain, and we had wanted to be at the Walker, and instead we stayed home and did this. We just didn't want to go out in this pouring rain. So we set the timer on the stove, and every time we'd set it for 6-10 minutes, and every time the timer dinged, we would start, "I remember," and then we'd say, "I don't remember, I remember, and I don't remember." And this is the poem that came from that. I remember rain like this when I was 25, an all-day trip to Cambridge, Rebecca 3, David searching for his dissertation advisor, who on a leave from Stanford, writing on E.M. Forrester, had stumbled on some photos, then lost them, very rare. I remember waiting in a car all day in the rain, coming down, Rebecca 3, and full of questions as the two of us stared out the sheeting windows at the old streets, sidewalks, spires, Cambridge in the distance. I remember gray, the buildings, the sky, even the red Volkswagen convertible from the inside. I remember waiting, David gone a long, long time. Twilight came. When I think back, he might not have returned. What then would we have done? Were we in Cambridge in 65 just because he was? I remember rain like this another time, a house along a road in Minnesota, its red frame windows, peeling paint, After 4 long days of springtime rains, the lost septic tank underground groaned, turned over, then emptied itself up into the house. Asthmatic, David fled to his office in the dead of night to merely live. I don't remember rain like that much in between. In Cambridge, Rebecca had to pee. We didn't know where we were, so I held her small self out over the nearby curbstone gutter by our car and watched her yellow urine hurtle down a slanting road blended with the rain. Back in Northfield, the children headed for the woods to pee. Small toothbrushes, glasses, and water clutched tight in their fists. Before school one morning, I found Allison on the lip of our southwest window well, proud in her comfort as she pooped in our yard. I don't remember how long my hair was in either instance, or how I was as woman, wife, or mom. No journals live to tell. In the first siege of pouring rain, I was not a writer. In the second siege, I was. I don't remember all of how this came about, but this is some. Those long Midwestern winter days, children in and out of doors, in and out of snowsuits, forts, and boots so many times a day, always it seemed they had to pee. I would dress them down to skin, dress them up again. In both instances, I was young. I didn't know it then. I know my father was alive in the first rain, gone in the second, like Barrett's husband in Giants. He disappeared in the dead of winter. I know that young woman holding the girl over the gutter on the Cambridge street as pee streamed away to rain knew very little about who she was in Cambridge or why she had become the mother of that child or what the price. Nor had she learned much 10 years later, though her dad had left the family and his life, and she had taken a job for a little money, picked up a pencil, and talked. I know David never found his academic advisor that day in Cambridge when I was 25. After hours of search, he returned to the car. We all went dolefully home, the windshield wipers slashing. That's all I ever saw of Cambridge in my life. And I know we found the septic system. After days of search and authorities, even a husband-wife team with witching rods, we found the poison gas, forced it back into the ground. The kids have grown now far too old to hold over any gutter. I remember phone calls then, that magic feat of someone's voice whom you love flying over wires to yours, telling you something that changes you right where you stand like a godmother's wand, like Mom's call that January saying Dad had fallen dead. A big man gone right to the floor, guest in a friend's kitchen, Mom snowbound at the ranch, cloistered in an upper bedroom with their shared history. No one could reach her for hours. When the state snowplows finally got through, she'd been glad that she could not be reached. Rebecca remembers me taking that call, the look on my face, the crying, how the snow came down, ice too, a sheet of glass that carried us to the last air flight out of Minneapolis in 3 days. I don't remember how I felt about that call as I remember waiting in the Volkswagen on the gray Cambridge street years before. I don't remember taking the kids to Ruth's, but I remember deciding to. I don't remember the details of my mother's long night of talking about her Buntrock family when we arrived for the funeral, but I remember she told us and told us and told us she could not stop telling us not of Dad's life, but of hers. I wish to inform myself about that young woman lost in Cambridge with her child's flay-legged over a gutter. I would like to talk with the somewhat older young mom of 3 who sent them to the forest not with crumbs, but with toothbrushes and water instead as the rains came. I want rain to pour when it's needed like tears, but to stay in the heavens when corn is already as tall as the sky. I want rain for cleanness, not for drowning. Rain to make distance easier on eyes with little pigment in them, but not for endless days of flood. I want a bridge from the Volkswagen in Cambridge over the child, the death, the reluctant septic system, the woman who could not be reached, the other one who cannot remember, over the torrent that has been transforming ever since. Tells you a lot in a few pages. And I'll read one very recent love poem. And I suppose it's true that poets who are in love with words would end a poem with the statement that I make at the end of this. This is called The Day of Hearts. This is a new book, and I guess I'll just plug it here. It followed me to Holden Village. I hadn't seen it yet in Northfield before it came out, and so it got mailed to me here, and it's the first book that I have with all my work in it. And it's in the bookstore, and I published it especially for the first 8 or 9 poems in it, but also to see them all in one place. This is called The Day of Hearts. You rarely write poems. Once when you did, though, we were in a cabin far from home before a fire with our eldest daughter and friends. I had asked that we write, all of us, to honor the day. And when you finally finished, you left your poem behind. Had you no courage to show me the sad words? Or maybe it was not what you intended to write. I know what I wrote that day was not. Back here again before the fire, I am unseasonably cold for March. There is danger in it, as though an unthoughtful moment could result in maiming or death. I know of some women who cross the Antarctic pulling their provisions on sleds, no dogs. Today all are losing toes. On the East Coast, you are caught in the storm of the century as houses fall on their faces from cliffs into the sea. Airports have shut down. People will die. Tomorrow, under my own power, I will drive back to our home, unlock the door for which you have forgotten the key, and wait for runways to open, for planes to fly, for I want your heart before me ablaze like this fire, but also I want the words. One of the great blessings in our life is coming to know about 4 years ago that we have a lesbian daughter. We did not know that. We thought, like lots of people, that we didn't know any, only to discover that we were living with one for 20-some years, and we had some things to learn. And one of the reasons I wanted to put this book out is to put a positive spin on the wonders and the blessing of being a family, with the uniqueness of the three children that we have. And so I wanted to put some things together before and did it in this book. The first poem I would like to read is called Before Language, which I wrote after a little argument with Allison here at Holland Village when she was 8 years old. Then I read it and it embarrassed her. She told me she didn't like it, that I had read it out loud. But the wonder of it is that only a couple years ago she invited me up to a coffee house at St. Olaf and sang a song in answer to it. And I think she's going to do that for you tonight, but I'll read you the poem first. This is called Before Language. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me and I would like to talk to you in the language of women easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong. My humor like a tune off key, not well received in your heart or your ear. But I promise I will wait for a day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memories of another time when in the womb, strumming the same chord, we needed no words. You arrived running, all bone and sinew, and on every photo after, one sock wrinkles down. Later word comes from Lesbos that you are here only for a visit. I had thought you mine, that I could own you in my image, but you insist and show me that wonderful mind of your own, revealing the riblocked secret, your becoming self coming fast before my very heart. I don't remember when I first knew of the wild gene loose in our family, but dressed in fringed leather, I stalked it all of my youth from the back of a horse, and I avoided men till one unlike the others came and stopped my quest. I saw it first, though, in a farm-bred aunt who left the farm by bus to teach from coast to coast. Always on the move, she kept open invitation wherever she lived for those who didn't fit. Then a nephew, drawn at 10 to the religion his mother left to marry a Lutheran, sought a monastery education like a moth finds flame. And you came, adept at math and music and secrets. I am surprised it took me so long to recognize the gate when at age 1 you careened down the hall of our first home, marked even then by the wild gene. I don't know how to say this. You are not what I expected. Your father and I came together at a particular moment in our knowing, and from deep inside me you already were made in the image of the great God who loves you even more than I do, and that is saying something. Made in my image, too, of course, and your father's, those young years when you looked like him, the tomboy ones when you walked like me, and now a woman on course among careless teachings and wrong-headed ones. You make your way all the while, reaching a hand back to me. I will keep up, but I'm not as young as you nor as urgent, but I am coming, dear heart, I am coming. Do not get out of sight. I will bring the others. And the last one I'll read is called Bringing Up Parents. You young parent in the city park with your proud eyes following that child over the jungle gym, think of it. She might be a baby dyke, the photos in her baby book revealing forever what you cannot yet name. Or you with the brown-eyed son who loves costumes, then lives in them, adopts another name for weeks at a time, insists on velvet, sometimes lace. Or the two of you, much decorated Navy captain and city librarian wife with the ramrod young man, taking all the honors in his class at West Point, yet he seldom writes home, holds his secret so tightly to his chest that if he held out his hands, he might fly straight off the planet. So straight-laced this culture, narrow, no room for a gay heart to spread its wings, soar, damage done early. Parents of gay children, throw off your embarrassment. Send with pride that family Christmas photograph with your daughter holding her beloved's hand. New breed of pioneers, their child, much-loved grandbaby, cavorting between them. Two wonderful mamas taking their urgent time bringing us all up. And back to the foreign language. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me, and I would like to talk to you in the language of women easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong. My humor like a tune off key, not well received in your ear or your heart. But I promise you, I will wait for a day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memory.